Welcome to the Neutral Ground. How many roads must a man travel before you can call him a man? The answer is almost always one more than he thinks he can handle. Now that's the poetically philosophical answer. The real one is probably more akin to it depends on the roads and how many roadblocks have been placed in front of him, either by life or by other humans. My guest this week on the show is Dr. Marlon Ross. Marlon teaches in English and American Studies departments at the University of Virginia. He's a scholar of race, gender, and queer theory, focusing particularly on 20th century African American culture and 19th century British literature. In addition to Sissy Insurgencies, the book that we're going to be focusing on today, he has published Manning the Race, Reforming Black Men in the Jim Crow Era, and The Contours of Masculine Desire, Romanticism and the Rise of Women's Poetry. In this episode, we're going to talk about what it means to be masculine, and we focus a good chunk of the time on James Baldwin's ability to hold any room in which he is speaking captive, and how that is a type of insurgent masculinity. We also discuss the famous Fab Five college basketball players of the University of Michigan from the early to mid-90s, and we dive into a little bit of one of my favorite movies, 12 Angry Men, starring Henry Fonda. If you want to support the podcast, make sure you hit the subscribe/follow button, leave a kind rating or review where applicable, and share an episode of the podcast with your friends on social media. And while you're there, follow me on social media as well. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Marlon Ross. Marlon, welcome to the Neutral Ground. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. That's one of the first times someone's asked me that. Yes, I'm quite excited, actually, about this conversation. And I want to jump right into this by kind of asking you, what led you to wanting to explore this topic? We're discussing your book, Sissy Insurgencies, A Racial Anatomy of Unfit Manliness. What kind of prompted you to want to explore this topic in such detail?
It was a long time in the making. My original training is as a British Romantic scholar. That's what I studied in graduate school, and that's what I taught and researched and wrote on for the first decade of my career. But the focus was on largely on gender in Romanticism, and I got a query from someone who was putting a volume together asking me to write on African-American sexuality. And I'd never written on that. And so I was, surprised, but I thought, well, let me give it some thought. I wrote an essay that actually was rejected from the volume, which I find very funny. But but it started me on this journey. I had already begun to transition to do African-American literature and culture as well. So I decided maybe I should investigate gender in African-American literature and culture. And that led to a project that I'm still engaged in, the first volume of which is called Manning the Race. This is embarrassing, actually. The Manning the Race was so humongous, just in terms of the amount of text. And I was having such trouble. It seemed as though there were too many arguments going on at once. So what I did, I decided to do a second volume. But before completing the second volume, which is almost done, I got interested in a problem that occurred to me when I was writing one of the chapters for The Color of Manhood that dealt with Booker T. Washington. That second chapter in Sissy Insurgencies on Washington and Carver. It actually started out as a chapter that was in the other book, the Manning the Race, and it got excised. And I thought there's something going on here that I haven't fully dealt with. It was mentioned in passing. And the more I thought about it, the more curious I found Du Bois' attack on Washington as a kind of what we would today call punking. And so I wanted to investigate that further and to think about this interaction between Du Bois and Washington in terms of Black male changing ideas about Black male leadership. So that led me to decide that I really wanted to do that book before completing the other project. And that's what I did. I also had two essays that I enveloped into the study. One was an essay on the Black male public intellectuals, the straight sissy intellectual. And the other was on James Baldwin. There was a section, there was an essay I did out of which the James Baldwin chapter grew.
That's wonderful. You know what, that reminds me of telling a student, an old student of mine who went on he's doing a PhD now. I told him one of my pieces of advice was don't throw away anything that you write, right? Because anything that you write can become something, right? So you take that chapter and you've got this great book out of this now too.
Well, the problem is I have a problem with being succinct when I write. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do this book before returning to the project. I wanted to write a book that was relatively short. It turned out not to be, but one of the readers wanted me to add a chapter. The press didn't want any more chapters, but one of the readers wanted me to add a chapter on Carver, to instead of just a section at the end of that second chapter, to add a whole other chapter on Carver. And I said, no, don't send me down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. Once you get going, right? I mean, it's not as if the ideas ever stop when you're writing, right? They just keep coming. So you could keep adding, you know, forever. Well, something that I love in your book right from the beginning, you don't shy away from asking difficult questions. In fact, the title of your first chapter is Can the Sissy Be Insurgent? And so I'm going to ask you to answer that question up front. And then talk a little bit about how your research, whether it was in the book or with even your other project, how did your research and writing lead you to that answer?
I'm glad that you noted that it starts with the question, because I do take the title of the book to be perhaps paradoxical or unexpected. Juxtaposition, because sissies are not normally or normatively thought of as insurgent. But the more I thought about both African-American cultural formations and also the history of queer male embodiment within the U.S. more largely, I thought about Stonewall, and it's now become a truism, fortunately, that on the front line, if we can use that metaphor of Stonewall, were men who were then considered cross-dressers. Now we would consider them trans. They would certainly in that time they would have been called sissies. And so they were certainly insurgent when they were fighting back, resisting the police raid that happened at the Stonewall Bar. And I sort of think of many other instances of this in connection with a long tradition it's hard to say when it begins, but a long tradition in African-American culture of what's called the fierce sissy, or the street smart sissy, or the knife wielding sissy. And I thought there's this figure counters the dominant notion of the sissy, one of whose meanings has been a coward, a weakling, someone who's too vulnerable to penetration of a variety of kinds. And so I thought, well, we have historical evidence for insurgent sissies. So perhaps this is something that should be investigated in greater detail. So the sissy certainly can be insurgent. The challenge or the difficulty becomes that the sissy is not usually perceived as such, even when the sissy is being insurgent. And for me, the reason James Baldwin is at the center of the book is because it was a case of a very self-politically aware insurgent sissy, both in his physical posture across the news media of the time, and also in terms of his intelligence, and yet someone who was constantly being misrecognized deliberately as not insurgent because of his sissiness.
Well, I was going to wait to get into Baldwin, but you know what? Let's just do it, because this is fascinating. First thing first, I want you to make a distinction that I think will help set up our conversation a little bit here. In the book, you talk about a difference between conduct and habit. And I found that fascinating. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that distinction first and why it's so important to keep that separated?
Yeah. One of the minor motifs of the book is a small argument with the theories of performativity as a way of understanding, especially gender enactment among marginalized groups, and perhaps among everyone, actually. But because performativity focuses so much on the repeated act of performing a role, I was thinking that it glosses human experience too blunt an edge, and that when I think of the enactment of gender in everyday human experience, I think about the ways in which there are various vectors for let's say performing, let's use that term for a moment, and for understanding how gender operates. I wanted to make the distinction. So for me, the distinction between performance or performativity and identity, let's say, which is too for an extreme for me. I wanted something in the middle of those two. I came up originally with conduct as a way of trying to bridge and interrogate both identity and performativity at once, because conduct is obviously a performance of some form, but it's a performance that is so deeply rooted, to call it merely a performance and make it feel so ephemeral just did not seem intuitive to me. And so once I came up with the idea of conduct as a sort of a self-interrogating bridge between these two polar oppositions within the discourse on gender, I thought conduct itself is not fully satisfactory. because it, I liked conduct also because of its relationship to ethos and ethics. And I feared that performativity, even as it has a very strong identifiable ideological and political agenda, that it kind of short circuits around the question of ethics. And for me, the question of ethics is unavoidable when thinking about gender, because so much of gender stigma is related to morality. So I wanted to tease out the notion of conduct as a form of behavior. And the first thing I thought about was conduct versus behavior, because behavior is so scientific sounding and also tends to be thought of in terms of biology. And I do use behavior, though I use it more cautiously, to think about, you know, this really deep-seated rootedness. But for me, conduct is the way we learn to be in the world as a result of both internal pressures and external circumstances. And the way we learn to be in the world is in some sense not very fungible. We can change our conduct. Obviously, that's part of the intrinsic meaning within conduct. We can change our conduct, but it's very, very hard to do the more we get ensconced within it. And that to me became behavior, you know, that behavior is something that seems even more fixed. And it may have some biological relationship. I don't know, I'm not a scientist, but it goes to the question of those LGBTQ people who are adamant that their gender is not, or their sexual orientation is not a choice, but is inborn. So I wanted to keep a tincture of that. And then I started to think about other modes. And for me, immediate conduct, and you said the other one, and I just forgot.
Habit.
Yeah. Yes. Conduct does have a strong enough dimension of the repetition of an action in relation to circumstance, internal pressure, and ethos. But we have all of these concepts of habituation. You know, habit has within itself this notion of something that becomes, let's say, second nature because it is repeated in almost an obsessive or subliminal way. And I thought habit was especially useful because it also gets at a different aspect of the problem of ethics. We fall into habits when we stop thinking about the ethical implications of our conduct. So I was trying to just jostle quite a few things because I also, the last thing I'll say about this is I also wanted to think more aggressively about the relationship between bodily conduct, a way that we move in the world, and character, the way we proceed and are perceived beyond the body or through the body in the world. And so this notion of habit, we have bodily habitus, right? We have a bodily habitus, the way we make our way in the world with our bodies, but we also have a mental or cognitive habitus, the way we learn through this maneuvering of the body, or maybe the other way around, the way our body learns through the habits that we've developed mentally as we accrue experience in the world. Does that clarify?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, what I appreciated so much about your discussion there of performativity is that oftentimes a discussion of performativity tends to focus mostly on, only on, how the individual themselves either wants to be perceived or wants to show. It's about the individual. What I appreciated about the nuance of your discussion here in bringing in this idea of conduct and habit is that you take into consideration, I think more so than many, one, the unconscious aspect sometimes of habituation, like you said, which is oftentimes that we have outside forces that we're not consciously aware of that create this habituation within us. And we are performing them without even knowing it. And oftentimes when someone points it out to us, we're almost in a state of anger because it feels like something outside of us has taken control. So I appreciated that nuance that you have there of extending performativity. And the other part of that too, and for this part, I want to read something that you wrote here because it speaks to the externalization part really well. You write, "For a Black man who would seek to head the race," and this will connect with Baldwin as well, "gender conduct is not merely a question of how he comports himself in relation to Blacks and whites, but also a matter of how the public, Black and white, perceives and receives that comportment through a gender vocabulary both cognizant and inchoate." And I stopped at that line and I made a note about it, but can I ask you to flesh that out a little bit more here for us?
Sure. I feel that it's so difficult not to get entangled because when we're thinking of any sort of cultural formation or collective formation like race or gender. I try to build into the way I think about it the kinds of cautions that that always have to be there in terms of the variability, right? But the variability within the self and within the collective experience. This idea really emerged in relation to Booker T. Washington. I can't remember the first sentence of that chapter, but I think it's history has not been kind to Booker T. Washington. And the study starts with Washington, not only because of the chronology, but also because his leadership sets up a particular problem in that moment and in terms of the legacy historically of African-American male leadership. It is very hard to know what's going on inside of Booker T. Washington's mind because he's so wily and so deliberate in making the image he presents the image that he lives, that he seems to be living. And of course, there are moments when those two things clash. But Washington, so this was the problem. Washington was clearly perceived as a proper, we would say, heteronormative leader of the race. And I understood why especially why the Northern white leadership, industrial leadership, especially would want to be insistent on seeing him as a proper leader in that sense. But I kept, in reading Up from Slavery, I kept coming across his misgendered self-identification. And that seemed to also, everything is calculated in Washington, at least in his published work, and to the large extent in his letters as well. He, just one example, the episode where he sweeps the classroom to be admitted into Hampton under the eyes of a white schoolmistress. That to me epitomized the problem of African American manhood labor. That African American men were obviously supposed to be identified with labor, but this labor is not just the legacy of slavery, of the body as the burden of labor, but it's also not masculine labor in the dominant culture. And so I thought, why is he taking on this very misgendered activity as the pivotal moment that catapults him in this trajectory toward Black leadership? And so I was trying to make these things correspond in terms of the politics of the time. And the result of that was the need to look at the historical circumstance. On the one hand, the historical circumstance that is almost demanding that Booker T. Washington, if he is to assume leadership in a Jim Crow regime, misgender himself in relation to white of domestic labor. On the other hand, it seems not just that external circumstance and not just the perception that he wants to have for those white industrialists of the North. It's also something operating, it's a habit that he develops as he learns to negotiate both his environment, not only gender and race, but just everyday survival under Jim Crow. And the last point I'll make, and then I'll see if I've answered your question, is that to develop this sort of promotion of one's own misgendered self in order to claim patriarchal head of the race, when you look backward in his biography, beyond his autobiography, you begin to see ways and you begin to, the rationale for developing that habit begins to make sense, both in terms of his internal need, in terms of his circumstance as a slave boy. And the when I came across this idea that he had gone to work in the master's household, fanning flies at the supper table when he was very young. And then I saw in the historical scholarship that frequently slave boys with that task would be required to wear basically a kind of little skirt that sometimes would expose their genitalia until they reached the age of puberty. It made sense to me that that much of his experience and much of his upbringing would have been conditioned by having to deal with these, let's say, scenes of boyhood or manhood humiliation that he had to find a way of defending against, coping with, and turning into opportunity, which is his whole philosophy, to turn a subordinating regime into an opportunity.
Yeah, you absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You answered the question, and it leads wonderfully too into when I got to chapter 4 of your book where you talk about Baldwin and Baldwin's heroics. My mind kind of really just started pulling a lot of things together, and so I'm going to ask for your forgiveness as I kind of walk you through it, because then I want to ask you what you think about these connections that I make here. So one of my favorite films of all times is 12 Angry Men. And in the past, in my classroom, I used to teach, I haven't done it in a while, I used to teach an essay by Harvey Mansfield called Partial Eclipse of Manliness. And in this essay, Mansfield makes the argument that one of the strongest characteristics of manliness is this notion to be able to stand up, demand attention, and be heard. Both of those things very key, like standing, attention, and then to be heard. In 12 Angry Men, there's a very famous scene, and this is the original with Henry Fonda and E.G. Marshall and stuff. There's a scene where this gentleman who is, I mean, there's no other way to say it. He's just a huge bigot. And particularly, he talks badly about poor people. He talks badly about people who have emigrated to the country, to America. And he does this throughout the entire film until one scene, and it's this beautifully composed scene of the entire room with all 12 men. This gentleman, this bigoted gentleman, gets up and he starts screaming, commanding that attention. You need to listen to me. You know, these people, they always do this and this. Okay. What's brilliant, though, about this scene is rather than engage in some kind of verbal or bodily war with this gentleman that they can't stand anymore, none of them, one by one, they get up and they turn their backs to him and walk away. And in that moment, that is the ultimate way to demasculate or demasculinize that individual and tell him, we are not going to recognize your right anymore to do this. And the very last moment of it, everybody walks away except for E.G. Marshall, who is sitting down still. He's the last one, though. And E.G. Marshall, the gentleman looks at him and says, you got to listen to me. And E.G. Marshall says, why don't you sit down and shut up and don't open your mouth again? And that is just it. His ability to use his masculinity as a persuasive act has been completely removed. Okay. That's one part of this. The second part, though, that connects with your work more specifically is, after I thought about that scene, I went back and I rewatched Baldwin's opening remarks from his 1965 debate with William F. Buckley Jr. And this is in Cambridge. And I absolutely urge everyone to watch this. Watch the whole thing, but particularly Baldwin here. He's in this room. And he's surrounded. I mean, the you could almost compose this like a film. He is in the middle of this room. All these young people, men and women, black and white, everyone is staring at him. And he more than commands the room. It's as if when you look at the faces of the young people, they're expressing what's happening here in front of me is more important than anything else that could possibly be happening in the world right now. And so that ability to command, be heard, but more than that, at a certain point, it becomes almost a hypermasculinity in the sense that it's almost as if the rest of the room will not allow Baldwin to stop. Like, please, you cannot stop. You must keep going. Now, my question for you is this. Is there something to be said for the act of great speech, the production of awe in an audience, in a room, that can possibly cut through our public need to conceptualize performance of gender? Or is there something else going on here with Baldwin in this room and his ability to dominate such a room?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, it's very interesting. It makes me want to go back and, I haven't seen that film in a long time. It makes me want to go back and watch it. There are several tracks I'm thinking of once.
Yes, so let me explore. Take any of them.
The first I will take is that Baldwin in that great hall at Cambridge is, let's say, a historical set piece that could be traced backward and forward. I wish that I had been able to begin the book with Frederick Douglass for this very reason. His all of the descriptions of Douglass during the time in the newspapers, journals, etc., describe exactly what you described of the audience in relation to Baldwin. And that it was, well, they do describe also this incredible mane of hair, and you know, he looked like an Old Testament prophet, they tend to say. But they usually focus on the power of his oratory to gain attention. You know, the reason I bring up Douglass is to sort of trace a prehistory for Baldwin, is because I think several things are going on at once, corresponding and to some extent conflicting. One of the reasons that Douglass's audiences were so compelled is that, obviously, this is an escaped slave, a refugee, actually. And there people traveled for miles and miles to see him speak. This was their opportunity to see this enigma before them. That this formerly enslaved person would have this incredible oratorial gift that reminded them of the Old Testament prophets. That part of it is he's exotic to them, but I think more than that is that he is fulfilling for them a part of their yearning to be confirmed in their belief that the enslaved did not deserve their slavery. And so if we move forward, so that's one part of it. In relation to Douglass, the other part is that Douglass understood that he had to overcome the habit of equating the Black person with the Black body and not being able to hear the intelligence. I mean, it's very fundamental in Douglass's time, because that was the debate, right? Does the slave have enough intelligence to be a citizen? Or not to be enslaved even. Now it's obviously not exactly the same thing with Baldwin, but there's a similar dynamic with both of those. There are some differences. Douglass was a relatively big man, and I think would have been read as very patriarchal, an Old Testament prophet, right? Baldwin was a quite small man and was fey in some ways. He was a sissy, visibly, and people talked about him as a sissy. I mean, I just taught Norman Mailer's chapter from Advertisements for Myself, where he has this terrible paragraph on Baldwin, where he focuses on Baldwin's, you know, sissy embodiment. He equates Baldwin's sissy embodiment with his overly perfumed prose. And that was the dominant image of Baldwin. We see it even in the Time magazine article where Baldwin was on the cover, where it talks about him being, you know, fidgeting and being, you know, it has used all of these diminutive terms to diminish him as a man. So he knows this. He knows that he will be perceived not only as a Black man, where some people will have a question of in their heads of, is he really capable? Is he really deserving of being in this honored place? Especially because his opponent was from a wealthy, highly, highly educated elite family. Okay. Mm-hmm. So not only his race, but also his embodiment, coupled with the fact that he had no education beyond high school, and that his worldliness, Buckley lived all over the world from an early age. I mean, you know, he's cosmopolitan. Baldwin's worldliness was very hard won. And so his aura, he knows from the outset that the thing that will gain their attention and keep it where they will really listen to him is only the power of his oratory, which is an embodiment, a material embodiment of the power of his intelligence. And the only thing I would add to that is that he learned the habit, obviously, when he was 14 years old, having to command the elders, the saints in those Pentecostal churches. And he put to good effect what he learned as a teenage preacher. But he's learned when he's performing this oratory as Baldwin, the public intellectual in 1965, he's standing on the practice of a long history of Black oratory that it didn't begin in Douglass, but Douglass is certainly one of the, you know, the first very, you know, acknowledged great orators. But it goes through every decade in American history. You see this as a practice that African-American men, especially women in a different way, but African-American men especially use. This is why when you look at those men who went to Ivy League schools, those young Black men who went to Ivy League schools and they were one or two in their class, they almost always win the oratory prize. Du Bois was one of the six or seven commencement speakers, right? But I mean, there's many, many instances of this. So it's a habit, a skill, and a conduct that African-American men learn to overcome these impediments that are projected onto them and that they may feel within themselves. And the last thing I want to point out, because I just taught the Cambridge Union debate in my Baldwin seminar last night. Unfortunately, we didn't get to it because we had other things, but they read it and we had a small discussion of it. Baldwin, when he was shown the Great Hall, there's a book that just came out on the debate. I haven't read it yet, but I saw an interview with the author. It sounds like I'm going to immediately get the book. The person who showed him the room felt that he was terrified. And I'm sure he was. I mean, you know, and he said he didn't understand. He didn't know what the form of the debate was. He had not prepared anything. So this was a few hours before the debate. He goes up into the committee room of the president of the society, and his companion was standing guard, not allowing anyone to come in, as he pulled together from other speeches and from his writing what he was going to say that night.
Oh my gosh. to be that brilliant on the spur of a moment.
I mean, but if you look at the debate, he barely refers to, I mean, it's all coming out of his head. It's just extraordinary. But the reason I'm pointing to that is because the one thing that one learns as an African-American male, especially put in institutions, in elite or elitist institutions, is you learn ways to negotiate your gender embodiment, whether you're sissy or not, your gender embodiment in relation to those who are deemed more empowered than you are. I mean, I think this is a kind of practice that's passed down in various ways within the culture. And it doesn't always work, obviously. It has its limitations, but it's part of that whole idea of being a credit to the race. That's part of what young boys and girls in a different way learn, even to today in African-American families. What it means to be a credit to the race has to do with how you conduct yourself when there's a large white gaze upon you. And so he would have been learning this in various ways, both subliminally and self-consciously from a very early age. Yeah, I like the idea of the idea that you know, standing up and demanding attention as a sort of masculine attribute. And I hadn't thought of it exactly in those terms, but that's the way I was using heroic, is to talk about the way in which what happens when you do not have the posture. The bodily pose of masculinity, and yet you want to gain that kind of attention. And yes. What happens when you stand up and you're short and small, right? All of those things matter, as we know. But one of my colleagues here in the religious studies department has a book on called Black Pentecostal Breath, which has a chapter in Baldwin, and is analyzing, you know, the role of Pentecostal. It's analyzing the discourse of Pentecostalism from a race theory and gender theory perspective. But one of the things that I found fascinating about his study is he talks about what happens when a female pastor gets into the pulpit of a Pentecostal church. And he does a very thick analysis of that. And I mentioned that in the Baldwin chapter because it led me to think about what happens when the boy who everyone perceives as a sissy steps into a role that is highly gendered as a powerful masculine role within African-American community.
Yeah, so let me pull some of this together too, because I had not thought of the Douglas connection there, but in the last semester, my students and I read Learning to Read and Write from Douglas. And what we talked about was, we talked about his learning through the Columbian Orator and the power of words, but then we dissected a commonly used phrase through Douglas, which was this idea of knowledge is power. We talked about that. And what we did was we actually said, you know what, let's actually break this down a little bit further. What's the word here that we need to really dissect? And we thought about it from the standpoint of what is power actually? As opposed to, I think oftentimes we would think, let's dissect what knowledge is. I said, no, let's look at power. And what we came to a conclusion was power in the sense that Douglas is using there is transformation. And so what happened to him in that chapter, of course, once he learned what, and it sounds silly to say, but Douglas very much means it when he says that he envied at a time his ignorant slave brethren because they were not aware fully of just how enslaved they really were. And when Douglas reads and he realizes everything that comes with it, with the slavery, he recognizes immediately that he has been transformed and that he cannot go back to a previous state. So we had a fascinating conversation about that. And with Baldwin, you made me think in that moment, the connection there is Baldwin very much understands, I must transform people here. And that is I think, essentially what he does in that room. He transforms it. And it's an amazing speech. And everyone in that room, like I said, their faces are just, and maybe this is the difference. When that gentleman in 12 Angry Men stands up, he stands up for his own. And it becomes a kind of caricature of masculinity in that sense. And that's what I think Mansfield talks about too in his essay. Whereas with Baldwin, it's people pushing him up. It's the everyone else but Baldwin in that sense saying, you need to stand and you need to accept that we need to hear from you what you have to say. And I hadn't thought about that before, that lineage, and Douglas very much the same thing. He knows who is most likely going to read what he wrote and who's going to hear him speak. And above all, he trusts that the idea is the words, the language, even the performance as well, all of that must be used to transform. And that is absolutely brilliant. And then to connect even with the pulpit, you're there for the same reason. You must transform the people in the pew to be greater and transcend who they are, to look toward above even you to a godly presence. And I hadn't thought about it before like that until you just said that. Something else you mentioned that I want to ask you about. You mentioned this in chapter 6. And you just mentioned it now as well, which is this, you mentioned the Fab Five from the University of Michigan in early 90s. And I remember them well. I loved, they were fantastic, really exciting. They changed college basketball. I mean, they really did. They changed the culture of college basketball in the early 90s. And it was five young Black freshmen who were highly recruited, top of the country. And they all decided to go to the University of Michigan. And what ended up happening was you had a storyline develop, which was University of Michigan offered this one view of this culture. And then you had the University of Duke or Duke University culture, which was this predominantly white culture. Where I want to bring you in that you mentioned was a conversation that comes up every so often, which I think is more complex than people give it credit for. One of the Fab Five, Jalen Rose, who's still very much involved in basketball today, you know, he's on ESPN all the time. He talks about how much he hated Duke, but more specifically, he talks a lot about one particular player, Grant Hill, who played for Duke at the time and was a young Black male, but going to this predominantly white school. And the two have had exchanges. And Grant Hill said something years and years and years ago that almost broke my heart, which was he said, I shouldn't have to feel guilty for my parents. And I thought, oh my God, I don't even know what to do with that. And so could you speak a little bit more about this relationship here between the two?
I feel as though I would be speaking out of a degree of ignorance because I don't know enough about Grant here.
Oh, yes. So let's go the route that you do in the book then, and the because I think this will connect anyway a little bit. The appropriation part you talk about of the term Fab Five with the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy production team.
I do want to, I want to speculate a bit. I want to, before yes. I go there, I'll speculate
sure,
a bit.
Sure, please do.
Because I was at Michigan when the Fab Five was there. I was teaching there. And No, I came just after they were. But in any case, they part of what's going on in that dispute has to do with two mutually contested conducts of Black masculinity as sportsmanship. And the thing about the Fab Five is that while people were awed by their skill, by their talent as players, they also tended to doubt or question the properness of their masculinity. They were read in the sociological term that I really don't like, but I'll use as hypermasculine. I don't like the term when it's applied to Black men because it's too loaded, but that's the way they were read. They were read as urban, and not just as urban, but as ghetto, and that they were bringing a ghetto ethic and a ghetto form of play into college basketball. Its place is important here because the University of Michigan, its location next to Detroit, et cetera. And a couple of them were from Detroit, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Duke is the Southern Gentile converse of Michigan. And, especially then, even more then than now, right? Hill, if I remember correctly, Hill was described in terms of, a certain kind of more genteel, a more proper manly conduct. I'm glad you brought, I hadn't thought about this, and I'm glad you brought my attention to it. It's something I would love to investigate if I get time, because I think it sort of, it epitomizes so many arguments that have been had in the post-desegregation moment. The argument between the now infamous Bill Cosby and his interlocutors, for instance. The argument recently that emerged in relation to Academy Award winner, African-American man. His name just slipped my mind. I can't believe it. His relationship, he also made a similar remark about sort of chastising Black boys and men for not occupying a sort of popular manly behavior. This debate has a lot to do with class within the African American community, more a perception of class than the reality of it, and the question of whether what people are calling respectability politics, and the respectability politics that is increasingly associated with the civil rights movement, is sufficient, or is even a way toward liberation, versus the image of Black urban youth as neither being able to be circumscribed by that Black civil rights narrative, and often seen as not wanting to be circumscribed by it. So that for me, that's part of what this represents in that dispute between these two. But I'm going to give it more thought. It irked me from the first moment I heard the term metrosexual, because I knew exactly what was going on. There's a wonderful book called Slaves to Fashion, which is about the African-American dandy, a history of the African-American dandy beginning in the 19th century. And this this idea of the metrosexual, it which was very popular at that moment. I mean, it really was everywhere. It's kind of dissipated. But the idea of the metrosexual is racialized in ways that I find both puzzling and pernicious, because it uses a sport and a sportsman, Beckham, as the epitome of something that is actually largely borrowed from African-American sportsmen, you know, going all the way back to Jack Johnson, who was obsessed with fashion and, you know, who was a dandy and who, you know, and not just men's fashion, but also women. I mean, you know, this is a long tradition within African-American culture that gets written out by the term metrosexual. And so I wanted to think about that in relation to the show that came on the heels of that term, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. And, you know, I saw many of those episodes, but I was constantly frustrated. And I was especially frustrated in the episodes where these five white projecting guys are teaching a Black man how to dress, and without any sort of reference to the styles that are endemic to African American men's fashions for generations. Okay. It kind of accelerated when I thought about the fact that they're calling themselves the Fab Five, and that the original Fab Five, these young basketballers, were fashion forward in terms of not only in terms of what they did on the court, the way they dressed, the kind of dress that they brought, but also off the court, which they were criticized for as well. You know, the Black basketball player gets reduced to basketball skill in ignoring these other dimensions of their interests.
That makes me think of, because I'm a New York Knicks fan. I mean, in terms of the fashion, Walt Clyde Frazier was incredibly well known for his fashion. And I mean, true fashion senses and a thoughtfulness about what I'm going to project. And for the people who are either maybe too young or don't remember or don't know, the Fab Five, I mean, the original, Weber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, who's at Michigan now even, what they did was they took the short shorts and they made the baggy shorts that were in vogue, even still for the most part today. Before 91, when they came in, basketball shorts were not that long.
Yeah, they were actually very short.
Yes, they single-handedly changed that and were allowed to sort of, were allowed to show that within the span of the game. But then outside of the game, it became more than fashion. It became people were starting to, people would attack them in different ways. It became not just fashion, but it became, you mentioned this in the book, this idea of the thug. And that was the part that never was able to get reconciled and probably connects back with what you were talking about between even Duke and University of Michigan. This idea of how society could not reconcile what was fashion on the court and then what was a political statement of violence somehow, the same shorts even off the court. I think you make an excellent point there. I do. I think you're right. Something that I really, because I you've been very generous with your time. I don't want to take up too much, but something that you do in this book that I found to be really fascinating was you spend a lot of time talking about the problem of that we need to broaden the spectrum of masculinity. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned specifically in the Black community for young Black males, how having this strict sense of strict kind of space of masculinity, how constraining that can become. In an age today where we find ourselves talking more about this, do you see, because I like to try to end on positives, do you see a hope there in broadening that spectrum of masculinity to include, you know, more?
Yeah, I do. One of my terrible distractions when I'm exhausted before I go to bed is, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm going to say it. I watch reaction videos to Little Nas X. Little Nas X, especially his the album that he put out in the summer of 2021. And to me, this is a hopeful note. First of all, I think what Lil Nas X is doing is so much more subtle than people recognize, because they like to focus on the fact that he's this out Black gay man in popular music and hip hop. True. But, you know, there's this work on hip hop that talks about the ways in which overcompensatory masculinity, which sometimes expresses itself as homophobia, is really a mask, because hip hop is so riddled with sissies. And, you know, there's a very interesting sort of pop book about this called, I think it's called Hidden in Hip Hop, but or Hiding in Hip Hop. What Little Nas X is, first, he's not the first to do it. I mean, there's Frank Ocean and there are others besides him, but he's the first to put it on such a global mass popular stage, whereby there seems to be absolutely no space between his Blackness, his manliness, and his queerness. And it's very deliberate. But the reason I'm watching the reaction videos is because I'm noting in the comments in a lot of the reaction videos, people are attacking the Black male YouTube reactors who kind of come at it from a rap perspective, a perspective within rap music. And there's this constant charge that all of the Black reactors are being homophobic toward Lil Nas X. It's actually not true if you go tabulate what's going on, but this is what they're perceiving. This is what they're taught to perceive. There are so many reactions by young Black men or young male interracial groups, or a young Black man with a young Black woman, who are just celebrating and just they keep saying, "We're so proud of you." And somehow this, you know, it doesn't compute on the people who are reacting. And usually what they're reacting to is young white men celebrating Lil Nas X and saying, "Oh, I'm hip with this, I can deal with this." But the whole, regardless of, you know, the constant filtering of these reactions by assumptions, thug assumptions, right? I think this kind of upset and the response indicates that as is often the case in American culture, as we saw in sports repeatedly, that until a young African-American male does it, it doesn't happen. It doesn't do the kind of shakeup. If a young white male were doing this, and of course we do have examples of out gay musicians, pop musicians, and we have, you know, Elton John, right? Who's British anyway, but it's not exactly the same thing because of the assumptions encrusted around Black masculinity. So when it's a young Black man doing it and doing it in such a sophisticated sense of marketing and of artistry, the shakeup is felt almost like an earthquake. and so I find that very interesting. But what I think it's really expressing and embodying is the change that has already occurred. That has occurred. And of course, we have a tremendous backlash to it. But the backlash, as is often the case, is so tremendous. It's because the people against it perceive that they are fighting a losing battle. And my students today, the last thing I'll say about this is, I know university is representative of the larger whole, obviously, but when I first came to UVA, I would have had a much more difficult time teaching the subjects that I teach. But today, my students don't blink. You know, they don't blink when they're reading Giovanni's Room. They don't blink when we're reading some things that are pretty far out there in terms of sexuality. They don't blink. And I don't know what's going on internally, but I have a very strong sense that this is, my classes fill up because this is something that they're interested in investigating. This is part of their generation's sense of their own identity, of something that they have helped us, the older generation, out with. So that's my positive spin on the broadening and the complication of those roles that have been, you know, those roles of masculinity that have been handed to us.
Well, first, a quick confession. I actually like those reaction videos as well. And I'll tell you why. I thought when I saw the first one on YouTube, I thought, who's going to watch this? Who would watch someone reacting to something? And then I kid you not, about 2 hours later, I was on like my 40th reaction video.
I know.
And you know what? I just left feeling good about the world. It's almost, you know, people may think I'm being hyperbolic here, but no, I'm being serious. There was something quite beautiful about seeing all the different types of people reacting, because they tend to be positive, at least the ones that I saw tended to be positive. And it was just a beautiful connective thing to see everyone together looking at this one text and connecting with it in a positive fashion. And to bring it back to also to our discussion with Baldwin, even with Lil Nas X, we should also recognize that, again, it's the crowd lifting him up, and that height of masculinity where you can get others to lift you up and say, we want to hear you. And that's exactly what happened to him. And in that sense, I hope this comes out the right way. In that sense, the spectrum of masculinity is broadened almost because of the work that he did, but it's broadened naturally, not in the caricature sense of trying to force it, which I think makes a difference. I think that speaks to people in a lot of ways. I do.
Yeah, I think so. I think the part of the moment that makes him, and the artistry of the skill of his artistry that puts him in that position is the interaction between the mass audience and his communication with it. So it is this back and forth It's the moment and it's, well, let's say it's the moment and it's the man. In this case.
Absolutely. Well, Marlon, this has been absolutely wonderful. I really appreciate you coming on. I'm going to have links to your book in the episodes, and I'll put any other links that you might want me to put. But would you like to tell people either where they can maybe learn more about you, or if you want to talk just a little bit about your, a little bit more about your project you're working on now, just to, so people know?
Much to the chagrin of Duke, the publisher, I have no social media. I watch a lot of YouTube and I subscribe, but I don't have any way to contact me except at the University of Virginia through my email. So I'll just say a little bit about the two volumes that I'm working on. One is a collection of essays called Race, Space, and Culture, which comes out of a course that I've been teaching since 2001 with my partner and colleague, Ian Grandison, who's a landscape architect. And that's a collection of essays on the built environment and cultural theory. My individually authored a book is called The Color of Manhood. And it is the second volume to Manning the Race. It is a literary and cultural history of the imaginings of masculinity for African-American men from the civil rights movement to the present. I'm mainly subtracting words at this point. I'm subtracting words. And once I get those words subtracted, it will be at the publisher, hopefully by the end of the year.
Well, that's wonderful. Marlon, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your time with us today.
Oh, I barely really enjoyed the conversation. Those were wonderful questions. It took me places I hadn't expected to go. So I really appreciate it. And I have enjoyed watching previous podcasts that you've done.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Marlon Ross. If you did, check out his works using the links that I've provided in the episode show notes. And also, if you haven't yet done so, consider subscribing or following the podcast on whichever platform you're currently using to listen to me on. Until next time, try to keep one foot firmly planted on neutral ground. And have a great day.